From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Jay Stevens. His book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream, examines the psychedelic movement of the 1960s, its origins, and its legacy. Also today, I talk with accordionist Guy Klusevic. When he learned his instrument, he played polkas. Now he plays avant-garde polkas. Susanna McCorkle is back in our weekly performance spot to continue her tribute to songwriter Irving Berlin. And critic Ken Tucker has a review of three movies by Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey that have just been released on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In the counterculture of the 1960s, LSD was the hippie sacrament. My guest Jay Stevens has written a history of LSD. Its role in the rise and fall of the counterculture is only part of the story. Stevens traces the history of the synthetic drug from its creation in 1943. He describes the LSD experiments conducted in the 1950s by the psychiatric profession and by the CIA. And he looks at the people who first began experimenting with the drug as a way to alter consciousness. It wasn't until 1962 that the Food and Drug Administration began to regulate the use of LSD. Stevens calls 1966 the year America woke to the gravity of the psychedelic movement. That year, three congressional committees investigated LSD, and California passed a bill criminalizing the drug. Jay Stevens' book is titled Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. It's just come out in paperback. I asked Jay Stevens if it was difficult to research the subject of LSD since its usage was illegal and underground.
The real answer is probably yes or no. It was difficult in the sense that the people that were involved with it are fairly close-mouthed about it now because it ended so badly. And they're scattered widely. Many of them, many of the people that were involved in the 50s, the therapeutic community, are now in their 70s or 80s. So in that sense, you had to travel around, you had to dig them out, you had to, in a sense, gain their trust and be passed along.
And yeah, people think you were a narcotics agent when you came questioning them?
No, a couple did, yes. Most of them really felt that they had been so misrepresented, certainly the early therapists and the hippie leadership. They had been misrepresented, and so they were suspicious. You came in with the black mark of a reporter on you, and you sort of had to say, well, prove to us that you're a nice guy. And once you sort of had, once they'd sort of vetted you, then they'd say, oh, well, you must talk to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and that's really the way it went around. It was easy in one sense because a lot of people involved with it really felt that they were involved with a story that was one of the major ones of the 20th century, let's say, a peculiar story about really an attempt to explore man's unconscious and possibly get in touch with this, higher spirituality. And so they kept everything. There was a man, Oscar Janiger, a psychiatrist close to the Huxley crowd. Early in the 60s, he decided that what he was involved with was a resounding story, and so he began tape recording everyone. And so you had these archives that a lot of people kept. Kesey kept everything, every scrap of every napkin that they ever wrote on in an acid test is in his archives. Leary had people around him that were assiduous archivists. And this kind of helped because of the nature of the story, taking a lot of psychedelic drugs in the 60s, one of the downsides of the drug is sort of a problem with short-term memory.
That's right.
So in terms of being a historian, it was really helpful that there were the archivists out there.
You're 32, so I figure you came of age at the tail end of the psychedelic period. What was your personal interest in researching the subject of LSD?
Well, I came of age at the end of the 60s with its shadow sort of on me, and I was always fascinated by the period, and I really wanted to write a book, and through a number of circumstances, suddenly I focused on the psychedelic movement, and the more I looked at it, the more fascinating and interesting it became. One reason was because the story I thought I knew was not what had happened at all, really. I had sort of absorbed a number of myths and rumors, and that was not really what had happened. And then as it, you know, where, what other story could you have? God, the CIA, G. Gordon Liddy, Tim Leary, the hippies, Harvard professors, all sort of crowding in the, in between the margins. Yeah, I fell in love with the story.
Did you feel that as part of your research you had to either do LSD for the first time, or if you'd done it before, do it again and get a direct sense of the experience?
Yeah, I sort of felt, I mean, that you couldn't write about China without going there. And when I started doing, I had done like a, probably, I don't know, probably a lot of my generation, I had tried these drugs in the early 70s, and I took them in a fairly, you know, you'd go look at the ocean or you'd go to a rock concert, somebody would say, here's a pill, take this. And at that time, you actually did. You look back on it now and you're a little horrified of all the things you put in your system. But anyways, I had done it then, and when I started researching the book, a number of the psychotherapists that were involved with it in the 50s sort of said, you know, you have to take this drug, and you let us show you what we used to do with it. You know, let us. I mean, if you read the therapeutic literature, there were claims made that, you know, they could take you to areas of experience that looked like past lives, or, you know, the classic one, you know, to the pure void, the cosmic meaning at the center of all. You could wander into that room. Leary called the mind that you found under LSD the land of 10,000 rooms. And a lot of these guys said, hey, we have maps. We can tour you around. And
what would you describe what that trip was like, or the series of trips which you took with the guidance of some of the people who were leading the trips back in the early days of psychedelic drugs?
This was one of the, I mean, we can talk about content, we'll talk about, I guess, let's talk a little bit about the form. One of the problems that psychedelic therapy had within the therapeutic community was because of the way a guided trip looked like. What they would do is usually they would mask all the senses because they want you to go inside. They want you to go into your unconscious. And so they would mask all the senses. They would usually start off with their certain pieces of music by Bach that when you hear them, you realize, you know, this man was, he was writing about a mystical experience. I mean, it seems implicit in the music. And that kind of carries you, that sort of carries you up and gets you into the state. And then, you know, you they guide you with pictures. There is one moment where they bring out a clear diamond, a pure diamond, and you look into the diamond, and the only way to describe it is you sort of leap over, you know, sort of leap across the canyon, and you're into another area of the unconscious. If you start having problems, there are various tactile things that they do that's very calming. What it's very similar to, actually, is what might be called classic shamanic technique. And this was a problem for the therapists in the late 50s when they started saying, I don't know why blowing smoke in the face of a person who's having problems with this drug works, but it works. Or I don't know why this picture of Goya's, or actually some of Van Gogh, you know, had a little bit of this state, why looking at these flowers will move them into a different area of the mind, but it does. And so using a lot of these peculiar cues, they could sort of move you around. Say, well, let's go see what's in your personal unconscious, and you're back there sort of experiencing something that happened to you when you were two.
Well, very briefly, did this experience that you had put you in the right frame of mind to continue the research on your book about LSD?
Sure. It made me... Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the research that you've done and some of the history that you've uncovered. LSD was first synthesized in 1943 by a research chemist named Dr. Albert Hofmann working in Switzerland. What was he trying to create?
He was looking for Well, in the early days of the pharmaceutical industry, they were looking for anything that would work. But he was specifically looking for a migraine headache cure, something for headaches, a pain reliever. And he was working with Ergo that had proved that they'd gotten a number of drugs out of it. And so he was continuing that project. And he discovered LSD.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Jay Stevens, and he's just written a history of LSD. It's called Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. LSD entered American culture through two very different areas. One is through psychiatry, which was using it as a therapeutic tool, and the other was through the CIA, which was using it in experiments. Let's talk about psychiatry, and then we'll get to the CIA. What were some of the uses that in the early 50s psychiatrists saw for LSD?
Well, there were really two schools. The first school, which in a sense, if you think about it, are connected. LSD was really seen as psychotherapy had finally found the key into the unconscious. It unlocked that locked door, and you could go in and rummage around. Now, certain people thought that the unconscious, well, what happened when you got there was the location of crazy behavior. So one group of therapists and researchers mainly used it to create what they called psychotic breakdowns. They really thought, this is a drug where we can use it to make people experimentally crazy, and we'll discover what craziness is. And so you had these people using it to drive people crazy in laboratory situations, and they called it a psychotomimetic. LSD in the early literature was known as a psychotomimetic. Another group of therapists, though, we're using it because they discovered that if you gave somebody a small amount of LSD and then you started them through the very traditional therapeutic sort of questioning, they seemed to have access to their unconscious fears, their anxieties. They seemed to get there a lot faster. So they thought, we're looking at something that will speed up the therapeutic process. You'd have people saying, a lot of papers were written where therapists said, I did in 3 months what used to take me 3 years. So those were the two uses within the therapeutic community. Now, do you want to get to the CIA?
Yeah, no. The CIA started experimenting with it in around 1953. What were they trying to do?
The CIA had inherited from the Nazis, and, well, I suppose all of the intelligence agencies around the country, around the world, had really started looking for a mind control drug. And the CIA was very energetically examining all kinds of possibilities, and when I think they were first attracted not to the therapeutic possibilities of LSD but to the madness possibilities, when they said, here's a drug that'll temporarily drive people crazy, they thought, possibly this is a drug that will allow us to control their minds as well. So they were, very early on got onto the psychedelic family of drugs and sort of paralleled the therapy community in their search for it. They used psilocybin, mescaline, all kinds of substances in their search.
Well, in a moment, I want to talk to you about some of the people who brought LSD out of experimentation into American culture. But first, we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Jay Stevens. He's the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jay Stevens is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. Jay, let's talk about three of the people who you compare, three of the people who helped popularize LSD. Aldous Huxley, the writer, Timothy Leary, who started off as a professor at Harvard University, and Ken Kesey, who was a novelist who played a big role in popularizing the drug. Let's start with Huxley. He started experimenting with LSD in 1953. What was his vision of what LSD could do?
Huxley really felt, he was the best way to put it, is Aldous Huxley was heir to a a desire among a lot of Western intellectuals dating back to about the 1880s that a way could be found to accelerate human evolution. Now, what's that mean? To Huxley, it didn't mean, and to most of the people that bought into this belief, it didn't mean that you'd get taller or anything like that. They really believed you'd get more conscious. As a matter of fact, the phrase cosmic consciousness was coined in 1900 to sort of indicate the evolutionary stage beyond self-consciousness. And it was coined by a Canadian, Richard Buck, and he really felt that people like Buddha and Jesus and a number of the other great mystics were merely like species forerunners of cosmic consciousness. Now, Huxley bought into this about the 30s, and he really felt that, particularly after World War I, and very greatly after the discovery of atomic fission, that a way had to be found to accelerate human evolution. And he really spent from about 1930 to 1953 a lot of his time went for searching for a way to get access to this cosmic dimension that the great mystics seemed to have access to.
Through his writing, he made some of the intellectuals aware of mm-hmm. these kinds of drugs. Let's compare his view to Timothy Leary's, who played a greater role in democratizing LSD and making it available to larger groups of people.
Well, Aldous ran into mescaline and then LSD in the early 50s. And, okay, here you've had a desire to accelerate human evolution, and you've discovered what you think might be the appropriate tool. What do? Huxley really felt what you did is you turned on the cultural, political, and scientific elite of the world, that these were the people that really changed cultures, that led people in new directions. And so he really spent the last 10 years of his life trying to interest these people in taking it and sort of trying to get people to research the spiritual aspects of it. And Tim Leary was, in a sense, I mean, if you want to use a crude word, recruited by the Huxley crowd, because Tim was at Harvard, and a lot of members of the world elite passed through Harvard in any given year. Now, Tim differed on how you might change a culture or change man's evolutionary curve. Tim really felt you didn't turn on older people that had their categories intact. What you did is you turned on the kids. You turned on the people who were still open to all life's possibilities. He also felt that everybody should be able to have this experience. Not, you know, you didn't need a PhD from Harvard in order to take LSD, that everybody should be able to take them, provided you were carefully guided. Tim would recognize that, you know, going into your unconscious could be very dangerous, so you needed a guide. And so Tim really said, well, you know, we will train guides, and every young American can have this experience. He'll just call up his neighborhood guide, look him up in the Yellow Pages, psychedelic guide, call him up and say, I want to take a trip.
Well, you suggest that Ken Kesey, with the trips festivals, and with his wide dissemination of LSD, took away some of those controls, and maybe by doing so made it more possible for people to have bad trips.
Yes. What really happened was the Huxley people were horrified when Tim sort of ran away in his direction, and Tim really felt everybody could have a good trip provided they were carefully guided. Ken Kesey really felt that controls weren't the point. They got in the way. The point was to freak freely, as they used to put it, to sort of, like, can you pass the acid test? It was a very macho ethic, really. You know, can you go and hang over the edge by your toes and not fall in a sense? And he also felt that it was a part. He saw the party aspect to it. All these other people were, you know, even the Leary people were sort of running around, still in the spiritual aspect. Kesey, you know, really saw the party aspect, and he began throwing increasingly large parties where, well, anyways, you can see that's a. These two philosophies sort of met, and I think the meeting of them was disastrous. Tim's sort of saying, everybody can take this drug, everybody should take this drug, and Ken Kesey sort of saying, you don't need any controls to do it. Take it and have fun, and if you go crazy, well, you didn't pass the acid test. And that's sort of was the making of a lot of the badness that came out in the late 60s.
Where do you think that the whole psychedelic dream started to go bad?
I think it started to go bad in late 66, probably. I think that it had, you know, I start my book with the gathering of the tribes for the first human being, and that was sort of, in a sense, that's the climax of my book. I go back. That's the highest moment, and it's all downhill from there, though it's going to take about, that was in January 67, it's going to take about till July before the people realize that, you know, they had almost grasped whatever it was they were seeking to grasp, and that they'd slipped. Somehow it had eluded them. So I'd say the middle of 67, it began to go very bad for a number of reasons.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people who were doing psychedelic drugs in the 1960s and in the early 1970s discounted a lot of the warnings that parents, government officials, and the press were giving.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why I think they were discounted was because they were extreme warnings, and also because the warnings were given from people who didn't understand at all why people were doing these drugs in the first place. Do you think that that's a fair assessment?
I think that's absolutely correct. One of the curious things about the area of anti-drug, I don't want to say propaganda, but in a sense that's sort of what it is. And you can go back to start and look at the Reefer Madness stuff of the 30s.
Well, people used to get stoned and go watch that movie. That was supposed to be a cautionary film about
that
marijuana.
That was a cautionary film.
That was
film.
Really how it was used source of entertainment.
If you read a lot of the Reefer Madness stuff, it was, okay, smoke a joint and you'll rape your sister and kill your mother and then commit suicide. And all anyone had to do when they started doing it in the 50s was smoke one joint and see that that didn't happen and sort of say, hey, this isn't bad. And, you know, the whole anti-message was lost. My feeling was that, you know, they weren't straight with the kids. And in a sense, what you had in the late 60s was two propaganda wars. You had Tim Leary saying, take LSD and you'll have 10,000 orgasms. And you had the establishment or whatever you want to call it, the cultural powers that be saying, if you take this drug, you'll go crazy. And what happened was a lot of kids seemed to be saying, if what you have is sane, then give me crazy. So they escalated the battle, and within the propaganda war, when they came up with the genetic damage argument, which was, perhaps you've heard of that, that if you took LSD, it would damage your chromosomes. Within the scientific community, that was widely belittled, the actual research protocol, the way the guy designed his experiment. But, you know, at the sort of media surface of things at Time Life, New York Times, it was given, you know, it was given wide play. And I think that in that sense, they won the media game, because the idea that to take the risk yourself was one thing. To pass it down through the generations, it was sort of a very cool wind that swept through the psychedelic movement. Also because, let me give you another reason, the hippies were very fond of the idea that they were mutants. They really bought into the whole notion that they were the evolutionary curve of the species were changing, and they were the mutated species.
The freaks.
They preferred freaks and heads. And if you've bought into that and then somebody comes along and says, you really are, or actually your kids are going to be freaks, it came at them, and it's the last thing they expected. And you can sort of, if you go back and read the history, you can see the convulsions that went through the period.
Does anyone do LSD anymore? Is there much of it available? Is there a market for it?
Actually, the only statistics you really have, I'd say there's more LSD being used probably today. If you go by the accounts that are showing up in newspapers than has been in the last few years. But the only way the government really has of testing these things is they give a survey to high school kids called the National Institute of Drug Abuse Survey. And the figures have been about very constant from the late 60s right up till now. About 10% of the kids in high school use psychedelics or have used them. So if that's any indication, it remains among a small group a very... still a potent force. Whether they're using them to gain access into a higher consciousness, I tend not to think so. I tend to think that they're using it like it's like a fast car.
One last question. Do you see any connection between the rise of the use of cocaine and designer drugs with the psychedelic movement of the 60s? Is there any comparison to be made?
It used to... to people that bought into the vision that this was going to change consciousness, when they saw the hippies in the Haight-Ashbury start using speed, start using heroin, it just blew their minds. And I think, yeah, LSD created and a lot of drugs have created an appetite for sensation, you know, and a lot of the people that use them, maybe 2 out of every 5 or 3 out of every 5 who used them back then, were simply using it, as I said earlier, it was like a fast car. Cocaine's a better sensation. I mean, LSD, you took it, you were gone 12 hours. You know, you really couldn't hold a job if you did LSD a lot. Cocaine, you can hold a job and still have a nightlife. It played a part, and it has certainly got a lot of kids that wouldn't have gone in that direction into looking for more and more intense sensations.
But without the pursuit of the more mystical.
Right. Vision. I mean, in a pharmacological sense, I mean, cocaine and LSD are very different drugs. They do different things to the body. They have, there are different pleasures. There are different downsides involved. But in the fact that they're a drug, they're illegal drug, and a drug subculture arose that looked at these things, they're related. And I think the cocaine epidemic that came out is one of the, you know, as Huxley would say, it's simply, you know, we haven't gone about this intelligently yet.
You did a little bit of LSD when you were younger. Do you regret it at all now? Do you regard it differently now after having written this book than you did when you were doing it at the time?
Yes and no. You know, at the time it was fun, and one of the nice things about one of the hard things about writing the book in the Just Say No generation is you run into saying, well, one of the nice things about taking LSD, and you say, my God, how is that going to sound? What are they going to think? Anyways, one of the nice things about taking LSD when you're young is suddenly the world seems alive. You know, you're looking at a tree and you're saying, whoa, that tree is really alive. And it's probably nice to do that when you're about 18 or 19, I think, to suddenly rediscover that there's nature out there, that you're living in a living world. And this is something that happens to almost everyone that did the drug. To use it sort of so foolishly, well, Huxley used to feel, and I suppose if anybody, I've come to adopt his perspective, that it was really best for people in their 30s because they, they sort of had stable egos, they were less impassioned about life. They were sort of in the midpoint of the journey, and that was a good time to reflect upon the big question. So I don't regret it, no. But on the other hand, I sort of look back and I say, well, I didn't do it intelligently. And then yet, you know, you also say, well, when I was 19, I wasn't that intelligent anyways.
Jay Stevens, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Jay Stevens' book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream, has just been published in paperback by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Brazilian musician and composer Antonio Carlos Jobim. He introduced the samba and the bossa nova to American audiences and had a hit in the 60s with the song The Girl from Ipanema. I hope you can join us.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa. Num doce balanço, caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema. O seu balançado é mais que um poema. É a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, porque tudo é tão triste. A beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with composer and accordionist Guy Klusevic. He started playing polkas in bars near his home in western Pennsylvania, but now he's pushed the accordion repertoire into the avant-garde, commissioning works by John Zorn and Wayne Horvitz. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle returns with her tribute to composer Irving Berlin. And Ken Tucker reevaluates Flesh, Trash, and Heat, three films directed by Paul Morrissey and produced by Andy Warhol, now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. There's now a tentative deal paving the way for the departure of Panamanian military leader Manuel Noriega. According to U.S. officials, U.S. and Panamanian negotiators have tentatively agreed on a deal that calls for Noriega to leave Panama temporarily next August. He would be allowed to return on holidays and then stay permanently in May of 1989. The deal would also allow Noriega to set up a transitional government before he leaves. In return for his departure, the U.S. would agree to drop drug charges against him. The agreement is subject to final approval by both governments. Administration officials say Vice President George Bush has expressed, quote, reservations about the plan. One child is dead, four critically injured in Winnetka, Illinois, where today a woman opened fire with two handguns on an elementary school classroom. Greg King of member station WBEZ reports.
Parents and neighbors in this quiet community of Winnetka are stunned. Things like this don't happen here, according to longtime resident Monica Baxendale Cooper.
My neighbors don't lock their homes at night. I do. But my neighbors don't. You just don't think of anything happening around here.
After the shooting, the woman, described as being in her 20s, ran to a nearby home where a 17-year-old boy was shot. Police have surrounded that home and are waiting things out. For National Public Radio, I'm Greg King in Chicago.
The United States has denounced an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Seoul by South Korean students. The State Department said five policemen and one student were injured today when radicals scaled the walls of the embassy, throwing homemade bombs and shouting anti-American slogans. This morning's incident in Seoul came one day after a student attack on the U.S. Information Building following a funeral for an anti-American student who had committed suicide. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said the U.S. considers the violence the work of a small minority of South Korean students. Israel is planning to reorganize prisons in the occupied territories. More than 10,000 Palestinians are in jail, and there's been a large increase since the Palestinian uprising began. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
In the past few months, Israeli authorities have opened five new prison facilities to handle the more than 6,000 arrests. There are more than 1,700 Palestinians held under administrative detention, jailed without trial or charge for up to 6 months. These prisoners will be moved to a large prison facility near the Egyptian border. A new military prison was opened this week for prisoners charged with a crime. In order to administer such a large, unprecedented prison population, a new computerized registration system has been installed. Human rights groups have charged that prisoners have been lost in the system. Last week, a 15-year-old Palestinian was released from jail after complaints from an Israeli member of parliament that the young man had never been charged. Palestinian families have had difficulty locating relatives after they've been arrested. An Israeli official said this week that complaints of maltreatment have been investigated, and three soldiers have been sentenced for beating prisoners. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
U.S. veterans exposed to radiation from World War II atomic blasts will now have an easier time receiving disability benefits. President Reagan today signed a law that allows those veterans to bypass requirements that they prove their disability was connected to their military service. The legislation affects U.S. veterans who occupied Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, and those held as prisoners of war in Japan during World War II. The bill also applies to veterans who participated in tests involving atmospheric detonation of a nuclear device. Consumer prices rose 0.4% in April. The Labor Department says large increases in food, energy, and clothing costs helped boost inflation to an annual rate of 4.5%. Many analysts forecast still higher inflation in the months to come. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down 5.64, closing the week at 1953.08. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For the past few weeks, we've been honoring Irving Berlin, who celebrated his 100th birthday earlier this month. Today, singer Susanna McCorkle salutes Irving Berlin by remembering Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
You can't think of Irving Berlin without thinking of Fred and Ginger musicals of the 1930s. I think that's where I first became aware of Irving Berlin as the great songwriter that he is. In this very sad song, Let's Face the Music and Dance, from Fall of the Fleet, 1936, we've only got about 7/8 of the way through the movie, so Fred and Ginger still aren't together yet, as we know that they later will be. Ginger's convinced that their love cannot be, and she's standing on board an Art Deco ship, and she's about to plunge in a beautiful evening gown when Fred comes out in tails and starts dancing with her and tries to persuade her with this song that they can be together.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon. Different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance. Let's face the music and dance.
They did finally get together, you'll all be relieved to know. In Top Hat, they danced this wonderful song about the joy of dancing together. From Top Hat, 1935, Fred and Ginger.
So that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Lucky streak. when we're out together, dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to go out fishing in a river or a creek, but I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. I love to climb a mountain, reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Dance with me, I want my arms about you, the charms about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together. Together dancing cheek to cheek, cheek to cheek.
Singer Susanna McCorkle was accompanied by pianist Ben Aronoff and bassist Chip Jackson. This is Fresh Air. Composer and accordionist Guy Klusevic got his start playing polkas, but he found his home in the avant-garde. He's expanded the accordion repertoire with his own compositions and with new works he's commissioned by such contemporary composers as John Zorn, Wayne Horvitz, and Robert Previtt. He's performed in settings as diverse as the Brooklyn Philharmonic, the American Composers Orchestra, the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and the new music ensemble Relâche. We invited Klusevic to our studio for an interview and asked him to bring his accordion. It's a beautiful piece. You know, I'm looking at your instrument and looking at all the buttons next to the keyboard, and I'm thinking that in a lot of ways the accordion predates the synthesizer.
Well, it takes as its precedent probably the organ. I mean, the register stops are kind of akin to organ stops, and instead of combining pipes, they combine reeds. And unlike the synthesizer, you can't really create different sound qualities. You can't make it sound like a clarinet or sound like a bassoon, but you can combine reed stops in different way to create different colors.
What are some of the colors you can get from the instrument you have now?
Well, there's a very low reed in the right hand, which goes down into the left-hand range. Later on in this a piece that I was playing at the opening scenes from a Mirage. I have this very low passage like this. And then the range goes up into the stratosphere. The high reed is way up in the piccolo range. And then there's a very pretty middle range. Which is more of a kind of a woodwind texture that I associate a lot with the instruments. And then you can, those are basically the three reeds. There's a low reed, a middle reed, and a high reed. And then you have all the possible combinations of those, which are more thick textures. Here's all four reeds at one time, which is kind of the traditional accordion sound, all the reeds going all the time.
The Lady of Spain sound.
Yeah, that's it. You just throw everything on you have and let it wail.
How did you first start playing accordion?
It was a cliche. I saw it on television, and I don't remember.
But who did you see playing it?
I can't remember, but I take my dad's word for it. He just said, I saw somebody playing it, and I just bothered him, you know, for a month every day until he bought me one.
Were you interested in polkas?
I got interested in them. Once I moved to Western Pennsylvania, I was raised by an aunt and uncle who were Slovenian, and they all of the family functions at the time, picnics or weddings, were ethnic functions. So what was being played by the band was not top 40. And I wrote a lot of polkas myself. I had a little band. And then at some point I became disinterested in them because the mentality of the kind of lyrics of the polkas were always kind of middle America. The wife stays in the house and we go out drinking and bowling with the guys and all this. And so, and then the music started to sound more and more like elevator music. I mean, they were not writing polkas out of the Slovenian community, but they were, like Frankie Yankovic was turning out movie time polkas. You know, he would cash in on whatever movie themes were popular at the time and do polka versions, and it seemed like a self-parody, and I lost interest for many years.
One of your big projects now is commissioning composers to write short polkas for you.
Right.
It's part of an extended piece called Polka from the Fringe. Mm-hmm. Are you back into polkas again?
Yeah, I am. I got interested in them again through Spanish music. I started hearing a lot of Tex-Mex music, and what was so great about Tex-Mex music was that there was a real tradition of virtuosic accordion playing. The players really got around on their instruments on these little button accordions, and the music remained rather pure because they were ethnically isolated. So it seemed to me musically it was interesting because it was a combination of German and Czech forms, polkas and waltzes. I really got excited about it, and that led to the idea of why don't I ask all these other people who have always wanted to write pieces for me, why not ask them to write a short piece? They'd probably have time to do that, and the form would be what bound it all together. And so I have 20 of them now from the kind of New York experimental scene.
Would you play one of them for us?
Sure. Elliot Sharp, this is an exception to the rule. Elliot's polka was already written. He didn't write this specifically for me. I'm doing a cover version of it. It's called Happy Chappy Polka.
Got a little box where I keep all my things. Got running water, living like a king. Got all I want, and it's always tough to eat. Even got a little girl, likes to rub my feet. Oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. Got blue skies overhead when I open up my eyes. Got no way, no misery, I'm never gonna die. Got lovely smiles, cause I wear the latest styles. Can't even begin to count my blessings, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh.
That's really funny. Mm-hmm. It's really great. And this all makes me think that my mother was right when she said to me in high school, Terry, the things that you think are very square today, mm-hmm. you will really appreciate when you grow up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true of the accordion, too. You know, I was playing it for... I've lived through the whole trend of it being an incredibly popular instrument to being an instrument that became a total cliche, to now being an instrument which is really hip.
But there's probably a period for you where it was maybe fairly embarrassing to tell people that your instrument was the accordion?
Oh, sure. I would, if somebody asked me what I played, I'd say, oh, keyboards, or I'd mumble, and I didn't want to get into a 20-minute discussion. I think what's strange is that when you're a child, you make very intuitive decisions. You know, you just do something because it feels right. And then there comes a point when it seems like it's an attitude to still be doing it. Now, if you're still playing accordion, it's like, how can you be doing that when you know how square it is? But by that time, your attitude about it has already been shaped, and you didn't make the decision as an adult, so it's not an attitude, it's a way of life by that time.
In order to have a repertoire, you basically almost have to commission people to write things for you, because there isn't much, is there, written for accordion?
Well, there is. There's a lot of European music that's been written since the 50s. Unfortunately, a lot of it is kind of academic European music. It comes out of the conservatory, and it's very kind of post-Bartokian and not original. And so the kinds of music that I'm interested in are not being written for the instrument unless I ask for it.
Do you ever have a problem of people thinking, oh, great, a funny piece for the accordion, you know?
Sure. It's, you know, there has to be a point when you move beyond the image of the accordion to getting into the specific sound qualities of it and not just what it conjures up mentally. In other words, once the piece is over, if you remember the tune or you remember the sound quality of the piece, rather than just remembering that it was an accordion, it was funny. I mean, the accordion in many instances is a sight gag. You see it and people start laughing even before you play.
Guy, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Can you play something else for us?
Sure.
An original composition?
Oh, why not? This is a piece called Old Woman Who Dances with the Sea, and I'll just play a little excerpt of it.
Guy Klusevic can be heard on his new album, Scenes from a Mirage. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
You know, usually we talk about specific stories that you know you're going to be covering, but on some days like today, the news is still breaking and you really can't be sure what's going to be on the show.
That's right. And some days we really don't know what the sequence of stories is going to be until the sequence has begun.
Well, that's pretty nerve-wracking. How do you hosts keep calm?
It is least nerve-wracking, I think, for me and Renee. We are in the eye of the storm in the studio, sitting rather calmly, waiting for the copy to reach us after it's been written and edited outside. Out there is sheer chaos in a day like this.
Well, we'll send you back to the chaos. Thanks, Robert. Stay tuned for full coverage of the news on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Recently, Sotheby's in New York auctioned off part of the estate of the late Andy Warhol. If you missed the auction but still want a piece of the Warhol legacy, three feature films he produced are now available on home video cassette. Critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Let's return to a more innocent time, a time when I was a dewy-eyed college student eager to drink in everything that was new, that was bold, that was daring, that was avant-garde. It was a time when I and millions of other sophomores thought that Thomas Pynchon was God, that Bob Dylan was America's greatest poet. Well, that one was true for a few songs at least. But it was also a time when we believed that Andy Warhol and his disciple Paul Morrissey were making great movies. Mystic Fire Video has just released three of the Warhol-produced, Morrissey-directed movies, Flesh from 1968, Trash from 1970, and Heat from 1972. I remembered thinking that at least one of these films was terrific, but those one-word titles blurred in my mind, so I went to this trio looking to see whether they've stood the test of time. It turns out that the one I had fond memories of was Trash, starring Joe D'Alessandro and Holly Woodlawn as bisexual junkies on a bad day. Joe D'Alessandro, you may recall, was a hunky youth who spoke in a bored monotone. In John Wayne's famous dictum, he didn't act, he reacted. But John Wayne would have been appalled if he'd seen Joe groveling for a fix at the feet of a hoarse, screaming Holly Woodlawn. What Paul Morrissey managed to convey perfectly was the grubbiness of Lower East Side living as the idealistic 60s turned into the me decade. There's a dirtiness here that isn't limited to the language. Everything and everybody looks faintly soiled, smeared with the grime of big city poverty. It's not pretty, but sometimes it's funny, as in this scene, in which D'Alessandro breaks into a swanky Manhattan townhouse to steal some things for drug money and is surprised by the woman who owns the place.
Are you saying you're trying to rob me?
Yep.
Oh, my God, this is the first time I've ever been robbed. You know, I'm only a rich newlywed with no furniture. You pick some hell of a person to rob, I tell you. I mean, no jewels. I only wear plastic jewelry.
I don't take it so badly. I mean, like, you know, I rob lots of people.
The only thing that we've got that's worth stealing is this damn plant. And my husband and I must pay $300 for it, and I'd like to see you get out with this, honey. By the way, are you joking?
Trash isn't the masterpiece of camp that I remember Vincent Canby raving about in the New York Times, but it's certainly not worthless. At the very least, show it to your mature teenage children as a lesson in what to avoid in life. Then when they're offered their 15 minutes of fame, they'll just say no. As for Heat and Flesh, well, folks, I've done you a valuable consumer service, the dirty work, as it were. I'm here to tell you they're skin-crawling bores. At least Heat has Sylvia Miles, the only real actress in any of these films, and the one person who succeeds in being something other than sullen or ironic. Other new video cassette releases include The Untouchables, director Brian De Palma's funny, surprising, rude, action-packed retelling of Elliot Ness versus Al Capone. It stars Kevin Costner as Ness, Robert De Niro as Capone, and Sean Connery in a supporting role that won him an Oscar. There's also Someone to Watch Over Me, a slick, slack thriller directed by Ridley Scott and starring Tom Berenger as a New York cop and Mimi Rogers as the endangered dame he's assigned to guard. The left-field recommendation of the week is the cassette debut of Fat City, John Huston's 1972 film about small-time boxers starring Stacy Keach and Jeff Bridges. The dialogue is vivid and salty, and the boxing scenes are thumpingly authentic.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with novelist Harry Cruz. His new novel is about a boxer who specializes in knocking himself out. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will profile trombonist and composer Rod Levitt. Kevin says Levitt, who wrote for marching bands and played at Radio City Music Hall, drew from every available style in the 50s, but produced a sound all his own. And television critic David Bianculli will preview the new Bill Moyers interview series on PBS. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.